to the day. I may have run over either on the way home for lunch or sometime during the day to see this sergeant on the boxing team. I don't really recall that. This was kind of suggested to me, and it seems like a reasonable possibility. Really, nothing stands out at all, you know, about that day, except I believe we played basketball for a short period of time, starting around 4:30. Most of the officers, we either played, I tried to get them to play either volleyball or basketball. The guys were always out of shape, and they didn't like to run the mile or the number of laps, but they'd play competitively. So I think I got the whole office to go over and play basketball for a while that day. Then I believe I went home, picked up both the children, and went down to feed the Shetland pony. And we had dinner at home, and Colette split for class. So I probably, you know, cleared off the table, normal procedure, and got the kids in their pajamas. And relatively soon, Christy would go to bed. You know, I'd put her to bed. Kimberly stayed up with me. Sometime shortly there after dinner, I think I was probably on the floor with Kimmy and had a nap. We were waiting for Laugh-In. We watched Laugh-In together. She liked the little guy who used to ride a bicycle and hit a telephone pole and fall over. He described Colette's return home from class and said, "After Johnny Carson came on, she went to bed. I was still up. I was in the middle of reading something. I believe it was a mystery at the time. I read a lot of mysteries. I started reading after Kimmy, you know, went to bed. I had the TV on and I was reading something or something like that. I usually just leaf through something or was reading while the TV was on. I didn't just sit and watch TV. I think Johnny Carson was a good show that night or something, and I watched it. There was somebody interesting on or something, so I watched most of that. And when that was over, I did the dishes and finished reading, or something. There was something like 20 pages or something in whatever I was reading, and I finished it. And sometime in here, Christy had started crying. So I went in and got her a bottle, which, you know, she didn't cry anymore. This was, you know, the thing the CID thought was so critical that Colette and I disagreed about. So I got her a bottle, and gave her a bottle, because we had not yet decided not to give her a bottle if she woke up in the middle of the night. That's all. Did Kristen wake up crying often? No. No, a couple of times a week. It wasn't a nightly routine? No. Do you know of any particular reason she woke up crying that night? No. As opposed to any other night? No. Did you ask her? No. It didn't seem unusual at all. It just seemed like something kids do sometimes. Did you ask her if she had a bad dream or something like that? What was wrong? Oh, I probably did. I probably said, "Everything's okay, Chris." And she said she wanted a bottle, so I gave her a bottle. But you have no specific recollection? No. Really what I recollect is she was crying, and I went in, and we sort of talked or something, and I got her a bottle. Do you remember what you talked about? No. MacDonald resumed his recitation. And then, after I finished the dishes and finished reading this book, paperback style, I went in to go to bed. And Christy was in bed with my wife, and she had wet the bed, you know, on my half of the bed. I don't know, really, honestly, if she, you know, or if she did not have a bottle. I presume if she did have a bottle there with her, I would keep it with her, and brought her to her own bed and put her in bed. She was 2.5 years old. She wasn't diapered. She had, you know, the bedwetting was a relatively infrequent thing. You know, she didn't wet her bed every night or every other night, or even like that. It was kind of an infrequent thing, or a weekly thing by now, and she didn't wear diapers, and I didn't change her diapers. She had a, you know, wet thing, and she had her bottle, and was going to sleep the rest of the night, so I just let her go to sleep. So I pushed back the covers to let the bed dry where she had been, and I got a blanket and went to sleep on the couch. Big deal. And the next, you know, there were some lights on in the house. There was a light on in the kitchen, and there was a light on in the main bathroom. So the next thing I remembered was I heard my wife screaming, and she said, "Help, Jeff!" And at the same time, I heard Christy, Kimberly, I'm sorry, it wasn't Christy. It was Kimberly. She was screaming, "Daddy!" Colette said, "Help, Jeff, why are they doing this to me?" And it sounded very loud to me. It still sounds loud. Kimberly said, "Daddy, Daddy, 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 help!" And I started to sit up, and there was some people at the end of the couch. The CID said was never in my house. And they couldn't find any evidence of 14 investigators and 3 medics and the CID and MPs and doctors, and because they couldn't find evidence of these people, I'm guilty. The CID can't even fingerprint a phone that an MP has used and get his fingerprints, and they tell me they have no evidence of these people, and that's why I'm here today. That's why. It is the most preposterous. They had no evidence that Ron Harrison was in my house. They had no evidence that my mother was in my house. No evidence the Kassabs were there. No evidence my brother was there. No evidence that anyone I ever knew was in my house except me. So I'm guilty. That's crazy. That's like something out of a TV show. I never said I saw hippies, McDonald said. I never said that. The provost marshal said I saw hippies. I said I saw people. I saw a person with long blonde hair and a floppy hat on, and there was a light on her. And I never said I saw candles either. It was a light on her face, and I had the impression that there was something, you know, a wavering thing of an intermittent light or something, but I still think it was like candlelight. You know, it was an impression. It was in the midst of a dark room, and over a period of 10 to 20 to 30 seconds, and I never really saw her. I saw hair. I saw a face outline and a hat, and that was it. That was all I saw. And while this was happening, Colette was screaming, and Kimberly was screaming, "Daddy!" And this guy hit me with something I thought was a baseball bat. McDonald continued his description of the fight, saying, "I couldn't use my hands well, because my pajama top was all around my hands. And I've been asked 50 million times, how did the pajama top get around your hands? I don't remember that. It could have been pulled over my head as I was struggling and let go of the guy's arm. It could have been ripped around my back. I just don't know. I just had, it was around my arms all of a sudden, and I was trying to push, and I couldn't get my arms out of my jacket. Like when you see in a hockey fight, when a guy pulls a shirt over the other hockey player, you know, I couldn't do anything. And the next thing I remember, I was falling, and I saw a glimpse of a knee. And that's the extent of all these allegations made by the provost marshal in the newspaper about fringed boots and white boots and black boots and muddy boots. What I saw was a glimpse of a knee in the top of what I thought was a boot. And, you know, it seemed, what I really remember, it seemed shiny. So when they asked me, was it wet, I said, yeah, it seemed like it was wet or was vinyl leather or shiny leather, that kind of thing. I never said to anyone that I know of that there were muddy boots or anything like that, and all these things get taken, well, you'll get to that. So the next thing, I was lying on the floor, and I absolutely, distinctly remember I was lying there, and my teeth were chattering, and there was absolute silence, and I was laying sort of on my stomach with my arms under me, wrapped up in this pajama top, and I remember laying there, and then I remember thinking, Jesus, I heard all these screams, and it's silent. And I got up and walked down the hall to the bedroom. He described discovering Colette, Kimberly, and Kristen, then returning to the master bedroom and dialing the operator, only to be told that if he was calling from on post, he would have to contact the military police himself. I don't know if I said anything or not, but I dropped the phone. I couldn't figure out what the hell she was talking about. So I checked Colette again. Sometime in here I had covered her with my pajama top that I think was still on my arms as I was coming in the room. Coming in and first, you know, as I was coming in the room the first time. I took it off and Colonel Rock was very interested in whether I dropped it or threw it. Shit, I don't know if I dropped it or threw it. I think I threw it away. And then I had picked it up again, and I covered Colette with it, covered her chest. And sometime in here, I picked it up and looked at the wound again, I guess to see if I'd really seen what I'd seen. And I put it back on her. And I remember trying to cover her. I think that there were some clothes in the chair across from her, and I reached across and I was pulling things. I remember that. I don't remember a white towel that the CID is so interested in. I don't know if I covered her with a white towel or not. I may have. I may not have. I was covering her, and I checked her pulses, and when I'd come back from the phone, it seemed to me that the back door was open, and I walked over to the back door and looked out, and I didn't see anything, but I remember thinking all this time how silent it was compared to how it had sounded. So I went back to Kimberly, and I think now that I gave her mouth-to-mouth breathing, and it seemed to me that the air was coming out of her chest. So the CID said, aha, she didn't have any wounds in her chest. She had wounds in her neck and chest area, the upper, the lower neck and chest. And all I can remember is it was bubbling. I don't specifically remember, you know, thinking to myself it was neck or chest. I remember that the air I was breathing into her mouth was now bubbling. And so I went to check Christy. And sometime in here, really silly, it really sounds stupid. One of the times that I was coming out of the kids' rooms, I reached up or something like that, and I felt my head. And when my hand came away, it had some blood on it. And I remember I was thinking to myself, my head really hurts. You know, I thought to myself, I wasn't even really, you know, making any sense to myself. I guess my thought was that it was blood from me, and I went in the bathroom and looked in the mirror. The bathroom is right there. It's like one step. It's not like a long voyage, it's one step. And I stepped into the bathroom and I, you know, I really can't put that in there. You know, it's put in narratives, it's put into testimony. So now you know, if you really have to pin me down and force me to say so, I think that I went into the bathroom the first time that I came out of Christie's room before I went in and saw Colette the second time. But if you knew how, you know, what do you say when you mean recollections? What I see is my wife and my kids, and I see bubbles coming out of their chests, and I remember them asking for help. And there's this dumbass operator, and I remember that I was talking on the kitchen phone, and I was saying, this is Captain McDonald, I need help. I'm at 544 Castle Drive. And she said, is this Captain McDonald? And I said, you dumb idiot, I just told you that, or something like that. I thought I was yelling at her. She testified it was very faint. Seemed to me that I was yelling at her. And then there were some clicks and buzzes and all kinds of sounds on the phone. And then a male voice said, this is Sergeant something or other. And I said, there are people who are dying here. We need medics and MPs. And I heard in the background, tell Womack ASAP. And I really don't remember anything else. In the April 6th interview there, they made all kinds of inferences at the Article 32 that I said I remembered going back down the hallway to my wife. What I really recollect, is I remember the end of the phone conversation. And the next specific recollection I have is I was fighting with an MP, and he was saying, relax. And I was saying, relax? Shit, will you look at my wife? Jesus Christ, look at my wife. And people were running by and shouting and screaming, and I heard, put that down, don't touch her, don't move her. And they were saying, who did it? Who did it? And people were struggling with me and pushing me, and I was looking up, and all I could see was MP helmets, shiny helmets, all around me. And I remember I was fighting with these MPs, or medics, in the hallway, right between the two bedrooms. I was on a stretcher, and they were fighting with me and strapping me down or something like that. And then I remember I was in an ambulance, and I said, get my wife and kids to the hospital. And the next thing I remember is I was arguing with this nurse about my social security number. She kept asking me, said, what's your social security number? And I said, fuck you. I said, what do you care what my social security number is? I said, I want my wife and my kids. And she said, they're all okay. And I was sitting up or trying to sit up on the stretcher, and I kept looking around and I said, where are they? Bring them in. And she said, they're all okay. And I said, what the hell do you want my social security number for? On the morning of the fifth day, Warheide asked McDonald about his wounds. Now, I've never really said this before, MacDonald said, because obviously I was the accused, and it sounds ridiculous for you to testify about your own medical wounds. But if the exam I had in the emergency room were done anywhere other than in the Army, it wouldn't be any good. It was a totally inadequate medical record of an examination from any physician's viewpoint. It's the first time I've ever said that, but it's true. And it's, you know, one of the two or three major reasons this case is still going on and I'm here, because of the medical record. I was never re-examined after the emergency room. No one ever came in and looked at me, and I don't care what anyone thinks anymore. That's shitty. That is inadequate medical care. So when I talk about the wounds I had, a lot of them aren't listed in the medical report. But that medical report is not a routine medical report by any means. There is no doctor that would be proud of that medical report. There were four contusions to the head. There was a much larger contusion to my left shoulder. There were three stab wounds, and then as far as puncture wounds, there were roughly 3, 6, 9, and 8, about 17. On the afternoon of the fifth day, Warheide asked MacDonald if he would care to make a statement to the grand jury before concluding his testimony. He said he would. "I'm sure it's going to occur to the grand jury," MacDonald began, "that if what I'm saying is true, how did this incredible sort of prosecution ever get going? And I'd just like one sentence to sort of give my theory, if I'm allowed that. It just seemed to me that Mr. Grebner and Mr. Shaw and Ivory made very, very critical errors on the morning of the 17th, never checked them, had the interview with me 6 weeks later, and from that point on they were set up, sort of, for a prosecution. It sounds absurd, sounds absolutely ridiculous, but Mr. Grebner has testified under oath that he walked into the house, made a decision that the living room was staged, and we asked him why, and he said, because of the flower pot. All he had to do was ask an MP. All he had to do was line the MPs up and say, has anyone seen anyone touch anything? He never did. The first time the MPs were questioned was 6 months later. Now that's unbelievable police work. So, you know, to come to a rational theory as to why what I am saying may be true or may not be true, how could the CID, why would the CID do this to Captain MacDonald? It wasn't any malevolent sort of thing with a nasty colonel in the background to ride down Captain MacDonald. It was, initially, stupid mistakes made. But then they acted on those mistakes. They never checked them, and they acted on those mistakes. Look, I'm here, obviously, defending myself. So what weight does my word carry? But to say that they found no evidence of other people in that house, when they had the back door open and the front door open and people walking in and out at random, with no guard at Kimmy's room and no guard at Chris's room and no guard at the master bedroom, preserving the crime scene. All you have to do is read the lieutenant's testimony. He had no idea how many men he had under his control. He didn't know their names. He didn't give them any orders except, don't touch anything. That's all he said. He didn't station guards at the doors. There were unknown numbers of people walking through that house, including someone in dungarees who sat on the couch. To reconstruct that initial hour after they arrived is going to be impossible. That crime work that morning was destroyed, but I suggest to you, sir, that that doesn't make me guilty of homicide. And it just seems unusual to me that the CID would make a lot out of some bloodstains in the master bedroom, which were 5 to 7 in number, with the largest being as big as a quarter, when my remembrance of the house was that the whole house was covered with blood. And it seems to me, when they picked me up and put me on a stretcher and take me down the hall, and then bring another stretcher in the hall for the kids and whatnot, before these critical spots are identified, you know, to incriminate me on that basis is absurd. I find it really insane, actually, at this point of my life. They take a wheeled stretcher with me on it, struggling, and wheel it down the hall and out the living room. Then they take photographs and state to me that I staged the crime scene. MacDonald's tone, as he continued, became increasingly aggrieved. What he seemed to want most to communicate to the grand jurors was the unfairness of it all. They also never bothered to ask the doctor if he had moved anyone, because to, apparently to them, very important fibers wound up under the body of my wife. Fibers that they say belonged to my pajama top. Well, apparently, we're never going to know if they could have belonged to my pajama bottoms either. But the fact is, they never asked the doctor, and the doctor stated he picked her up and looked at her back, and that the cloth could have fallen off her onto the floor at that point. In addition, I moved her. Apparently, they failed to take that into consideration. I know it's going to be very difficult for 23 normal people to say, well, Jesus, how can we believe this guy, when the Army and all these investigators and the FBI spent all this money and time, and they didn't find anything? They never set up any roadblocks? And then the CID implicated me because a group of assailants that were in my house that night were never found. I suggest that they weren't found because of that initial couple of hours where unbelievably bad decisions were made. And I also suggest that later on, when they got information about at least what sounds like good potential leads — I'm not saying that the leads pan out or anything, I'm not saying Helena Stokely is guilty, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that that indicates the type and the scope and the way that investigation went on. I don't mean to harangue the grand jury, I honestly don't. But some of the stories of the handling of this case are so bizarre that it is beyond belief. They never set up any roadblocks. Well, I'm on the stand. My life was shattered, like, you know. You can't conceive of what was going on in my mind or anything. And it doesn't make any sense. But I do suggest to you that I'm a little confused about the line of questioning about the girl in the BOQ. This is half a year later, after I've been through an unbelievable thing. And for someone to visit me in the BOQ, even if it did occur before my release from custody, which I don't think it did, is totally meaningless. Well, I hope I'm getting my point across. To say that I committed homicide and murdered my wife and kids because they couldn't find any grass or mud in the house is the most atrocious, insane reasoning. And for me to be here today is crazy. This is insanity. The Army reinvestigation was done a year and a half ago. $2 million and 10,000 pages, 3,000 pages, or whatever it came to, making sure that we can't prove that the CID makes mistakes. That's what they did. If you add it all up, it sounds terrific. They've had two Army investigations, in their words, the biggest investigation the Army has ever had, and they can't find the group of four assailants, so therefore, I'm guilty. All I'd like to say, sir, is, you know, you haven't asked me, but you know, I didn't murder my wife and kids.
Chapter 2. Jeffrey McDonald returned to California, but the grand jury remained in session until January of 1975. More than 75 witnesses testified. Gradually, a picture of Jeffrey McDonald began to emerge, a context into which the grand jurors could place the man they had seen and the story they had heard during McDonald's week on the witness stand. Benjamin Klein, the surgical resident who had examined McDonald in the emergency room in 1970, said, "I didn't feel he was in any great danger, medically. He was not suffering from shock, and his wounds were not bleeding very much. He was able to sit up by himself and to talk without being short of breath." Merrill Bronstein, who had been staff surgeon on call in 1970, said, "He was clinically stable. He didn't have a lot of things besides the pneumothorax, and even with that, he was not having any difficulty breathing, and there was no change in his pulse, blood pressure, or other vital signs. He had the bruise on his left forehead, the superficial stab wound of the left upper arm, the stab wound in the left upper abdomen, and the stab wound in the right chest. This last," Bronstein described, "as being a clean, small, sharp incision. It was only 1 centimeter in length." "He had no other stab wounds on his body," Bronstein said. Would you say he did or did not have 14 ice pick wounds around his belly button? War Heidi asked. He absolutely did not have any ice pick wounds anywhere, and I saw his entire body, because while I was there, his pajamas were removed, and I examined him from head to toe. Were you concerned about, let's say, his ability to survive the effects of the injuries? War Heidi asked. No. I was concerned about his emotional status. That was the thing that affected me most, the thing that impressed me most, the thing that I had the greatest difficulty as a physician in dealing with. If he had had more medical problems, then I could have dealt with him clinically and gotten my mind off the situation. In your opinion, it was not an emergency? No, sir. The most remarkable thing to me was that he was so upset. Bronstein added that McDonald had been transferred out of intensive care to a private room the next day. I would stop by and ask how he was and chat for a few minutes. I certainly saw him every day he was in the hospital. Did he have visitors? Yes, sir. His mother stayed with him a lot. She was up quite a bit, and I met a friend of his named Ron Harrison, whom he introduced me to in his room. Tell us about Ron Harrison. He was an unusual person. I never knew many people like Ron Harrison. He impressed me as being, and this is a surgical opinion, I'm a surgeon, I'm not a psychiatrist, he impressed me as being disturbed. I was worried when I met Ron Harrison. He told me that he was a killer, and he told me that he was going to kill the people who were responsible for this crime. He was a paranoid person. He was always worried about people being around. He said, "Jeff wants me to find them and kill them." And from him, I took this seriously. I mean, I really did. He was in every day, for sure, and I saw him after that. I was out with my wife one night, and he was in the same restaurant, and he frightened my wife. It was just the way he appeared, the things he said. He said things that, "My wife is a very gentle person. She would never think of killing anyone. She would not think of harming anyone." And he was talking about that. I have friends, or I had friends, who were in special forces. And I had friends who were not physicians in special forces, people that I socialized with, who I was in their homes and they were in mine. But they certainly, you know, would not choose as a topic of conversation or point of discussion with me killing and death. They certainly would never discuss it in the presence of my family. In fact, Bronstein said, it was the apparent closeness of the relationship with Ron Harrison which first caused him to doubt McDonald's innocence. Overall, he said, I think I could have accepted Jeff's story without too much trouble, but I was worried after I met Ron Harrison. He was a frightening guy. I mean, he physically frightened me. I just didn't know how he could be Jeff's friend. McDonald's next-door neighbor, the wife of the warrant officer, and the mother of the 16-year-old babysitter who had heard no sounds of struggle, testified. "He was the boss," she said. "He was the king of the castle, and he was, when he told her to do something, she did it willingly and obligingly, a very good wife. She was a very obedient wife." Until, the woman said, the early morning hours of Tuesday, February 17th, 1970. "I came out of a deep sleep, and I heard Colette's voice," she said, "and it woke me up. The voice I heard was mad enough to kill." Could you distinguish the words? No, but I got the gist of it, and I would swear on the Bible that what it was like she was saying was, "What do you think I'm going to be doing while you are doing all of this? Do you think I'm going to be standing here doing nothing? If you touch one hair of those children's head or my head, I'll kill you." The 16-year-old babysitter, herself, now a young woman of 21, also testified. Asked to describe her impression of the relationship between Jeffrey and Colette McDonald, she said, "At the time, I thought they were pretty happy because they didn't yell at each other. But now I look back, and they never really smiled. Colette never smiled, and Jeff wasn't too friendly after about January. Now that I look back, after January, Colette hardly even said hi when I went over to babysit. I don't know.
when I saw them together, they weren't, I just sensed that they weren't happy. In regard to the children's sleeping arrangements, the former babysitter said, sometimes Kim would ask Chris to come into her bedroom. Sometimes Kim would want to go into her parents' bed. I'd let them sleep wherever they wanted to. Kristen usually had a second bottle at night, and she would wake up and cry for it. Kim would wake up and cry too. I'd have to go in and talk to her. She would just cry, I think, Colette's name, Mommy. She would hardly say anything when I went in there. I'd just tell her her mother and father would be home. She just listened to me. Did Kimberly ever wet the bed that you know of? I think once. How about Kristen? She would wet the bed pretty often. The former babysitter also testified, after first saying she had no recollection, that the McDonald's did indeed have an ice pick. That, in fact, it was usually kept on top of the refrigerator, and that she would use it on occasion to chip away ice in the freezer in order to take out popsicles or ice cream for the children. The newspaper reporter who had covered the Article 32 hearing and who had interviewed McDonald on the morning the charges against him were dropped also agreed to testify. You have to understand what it was like to cover that case, he said. For anybody who was an attorney or newsman or investigator, anybody who was connected with it, it began to pretty well dominate your thoughts. I was there every day for 8 hours, 10 hours a day, and it sort of dwells on your mind after a while, and you start to wonder when you go home at night. You say, gee, I wonder what the facts are, and it really eats you up. I think almost anybody that has been involved with this since its beginnings is almost overly interested in the outcome. I am. I can't let it go. I keep thinking about it. I spent a great deal of time discussing 10,000 theories about why he would have done it, if he did it, or how he could have done it, or whether these four people existed at all, and if they did, where did they come from? And it's never left me, the feeling of wanting to know what happened. I'm just as much involved right now, and feel just as much a part of this now as I did then. You know, no matter what I'd be doing, if I was selling hot dogs, I'd still feel like I was part of this. So all I can tell you is what I saw, what I felt, and what I perceived through that whole thing and since. First, I should say that I never met anybody who knew Jeffrey McDonald on a social basis who didn't think he was totally innocent of these crimes, who wouldn't back him 100%, and said he was just a number one guy. They supported him fully and said he was incapable of committing these crimes, and at the beginning, I felt pretty much the same way. It was kind of strange because we were fed spoonfuls of his personality throughout a lot of the proceedings, and you spend 5 months with anybody, and you start to get to know them, and you develop whether you like them or don't like them. I happened to like Jeff McDonald very much. That's what caused the great emotional turmoil. You know, Jeffrey McDonald was just unbelievable. Here was this guy who was handsome and an All-American and a doctor and a Green Beret and all these things, and, you know, he was always very sunny in his disposition, and the whole thing was just unbelievable. I mean, one thing was, Siegel and his assistant, the civilian assistant, were a couple of clowns. One day the assistant brought his kids down from Philadelphia. He had this really cute kid, and somebody went in the PX and bought one of those little fatigue suits, you know, a Green Beret, a total Green Beret uniform, with a real Green Beret and a Major General's insignia on it. And of course everybody took pictures of him, and it went out on the wire services all over the place. And so that was, you have to understand the carnival atmosphere that was going on down there. It was just a really strange thing. There was no sense of reality to it. What we had here was an investigation into three brutal murders, and if you ever started thinking that way, it really got to you. It would happen to me at night sometimes. I'd go home after clowning around with these people, and I'd think, geez, we've got three dead people here, and somebody's going to have to answer for it. And that will kind of get to you after a while, because that wasn't what was going on during the day. It was kind of a light, frivolous thing.
Anyway, once it was over, I did a lot of in-depth investigation of the drug culture in the Fayetteville area. I grew a beard and hair and everything, and was living in the Haymount section for months. And for one thing, that's a very small community, and the word moves through it like wildfire. And you know, if those four people came from Fayetteville, and if they were hippies and they were drug people, somebody would have known it. Somebody would have known something. Somebody would have heard something. And another thing was, the terminology was just not right. Acid is groovy. Kill the pigs. People who lived in the drug culture, they call themselves heads. And I can't think of a head that would be so uncool as to say that. Acid is groovy, which was an old word even then, because even then, groovy was not a cool thing to say. And also, four people who are doing acid couldn't organize a trip to the toilet, let alone organize a murder of three people. Besides, LSD normally doesn't make people violent. The only drug that I can think of that causes that kind of reaction in people is an amphetamine of some kind. The grand jurors learned a bit more of what had happened, if not on February 17, 1970 itself, then at least during some of the months before and after, when they heard testimony from Jeffrey McDonald's former girlfriend, Penny Wells. She began by describing Jeffrey McDonald as having been in high school an all-American, fantastic person, whom she had dated and with whom she had been physically intimate during their junior and senior years. Now, at the end of high school, do you recall Jeff taking a job? Warheide asked. I guess that's when he started over at Fire Island. Will you tell the grand jurors what Fire Island is, what sort of place it is, and what peculiar features it may have, and what Jeff was doing over there? It is a place where people from New York City go on weekends, and there are a lot of gay people in certain communities. I don't know which section Jeff was working in, so I really don't know. They party all the time. Jeff was driving a beach taxi over there. Miss Wells said that at the end of the summer of 1962, the summer after Jeffrey McDonald's freshman year at Princeton, the relationship ended because she'd learned that he had been, apparently, dating or living with someone over there. Another girl? Right. And this disturbed you? Yes. I approached him and I told him what I had heard, and he denied it, and I left. I take it you didn't believe him. No. When was the next time you saw him? It was somewhere around Thanksgiving of that year. I heard he was in town. Somebody warned me that he was in town looking for me. I was in a restaurant with a girlfriend of mine, and I saw him walking in, so I walked out the other door. He saw me and came over to me, and I just ignored him. I just ignored him and took off. When was the next time you saw him after that? The day before he and Colette got married, he came into the office where I was working and said he was getting married the next day. When I went out to my car, there was a note, and it said something about receiving a gift. Something about your receiving a gift? Right. And in whose handwriting was the note? It was in Jeff's handwriting, and it was signed with his initials. Did you, in fact, receive a gift? It was left in my car. It was a negligee. It was red and black. Red and black. Were those your high school colors? Yes, they were. Do you recall Jeff having made any remark concerning your dressing in red and black? Yes, he did. He liked me in red and black. With the negligee, was there a note? Yes, there was a little saying printed on the note. Sort of a rhyme or verse? Something to refer to the negligee. Now let's go to April of 1964. Colette is in the hospital. She's just given birth to Kimberly. Do you recall hearing from Jeff or seeing him? Yes, I believe it was a phone call that I got, and he asked me to meet him for lunch, that he was in the area. So I said okay. We had lunch. And he knew I liked clothes, and he asked me about a suede coat, about me wanting one. And I said, no thanks, I can buy my own. It was only a short lunch, and that was it. I don't really recall what we talked about. Did he talk about you, or did he talk about himself? Probably about himself. And when was the next time you saw him? I attended a birthday party for his mother. I think it was in June 1969. I had dated his brother Jay a few times, and he had asked me to his mother's party. I had no idea that Jeff and Colette were going to be there, and it was a little embarrassing. I was in one section of the yard, and they stayed over at the other side. Mrs. McDonald finally sat down to open her gifts, and I was sitting right across the way from her, and I think I handed the gifts to her to open. Now, directing your attention to the fall of 1969, said Warheide, do you recall seeing or meeting or hearing from, directly or indirectly, or having any contact with Jeffrey McDonald? No, I had never seen him. Not on the Patchogue train station platform, she said, nor anywhere else. Was he on your Christmas card list? Warheide asked. I doubt it. Well, during this period, the fall of 1969, were you occasionally seeing Jay? Yes, occasionally. Did he ever give you any news of Jeff? No, never talked about him. Do you recall Jay having any problems? I considered him a problem. He was just a changed person from high school, his looks, his weight, his personality. Do you have any reason to believe that he had some involvement in the drug culture? It's possible. What do you predicate this on? Stories? Rumors? Now, getting on to February of 1970, how did you become aware of the murders? It was in the Daily News. I saw the name Jeffrey McDonald, and I said, gee, I wonder if that's the same person. I didn't know he was in Fort Bragg. So I went further, and I saw Colette, and I said, well, it has to be. Now, as an old girlfriend of Jeff, and as a friend of the family, what did you do? I sent a sympathy card. Did you receive a response? Yes, it must have been about 2 or 3 weeks after I had sent the card. It was just a very, very short note asking me if I had been contacted by the FBI, and to let him know if I was. Did you respond to this inquiry? No. I held on to the letter for about 3 or 4 days, and then I tore it up. Penny Wells had moved to San Diego in November of 1970. In February of 1971, her parents sent her a newspaper story, which mentioned that McDonald was considering a move to Long Beach. I wrote him a letter, a very short note, and said, if you are ever in San Diego, give me a call. A very short time after that, he called me from New York and said he may possibly get out to California and that he would call. Then, I guess it was around the end of May, he called and said he was coming out in June. I said I would pick him up at the airport, and I did, and he stayed with me for a while. Tell us about that. I was very disappointed in, I guess, his looks, first of all. Physically, he looked quite a bit different. He was a lot thinner. I don't think he was as good-looking as I had remembered him. And I guess I just got older and wiser, and he wasn't what... Well, I had no interest in him at all. We had just gone our own separate ways, and there was just nothing. I think it was appearance at first, and then, after a short conversation, I just had nothing in common with him. He wasn't as outgoing as he usually is. Did he show any interest in you? I would say no, not that he had a chance. You were just the landlady, a convenient place to put up with, without putting out. But back in the days when you were dating him, what sort of fellow was he then? A fantastic person, fantastic personality, always was out to help somebody else. In fact, he used to even study with me. When was your last contact with him? Just a change of address card after he had moved to Huntington Beach, and at the bottom it just said, super busy, will call, and that was the last I ever heard. Thus, By the time Penny Wells had completed her testimony, the grand jurors knew not only that it had been she, not MacDonald, who had brought their relationship to a halt during his freshman year at Princeton, but that he had attempted to revive her interest in him, both on the day before he married Colette and on the day after Kimberly was born. Whether he had also seen her in the fall of 1969, on the Patchogue train station platform or anywhere else, and whether he had planned or even desired to see her while accompanying the Fort Bragg boxing team to New Jersey in the spring of 1970, with Colette thinking that he was in Russia, could not be determined. What had been determined, however, was that MacDonald himself, even as he lay in his hospital bed recovering from the wounds inflicted on February 17th, was sufficiently concerned about how others might perceive the relationship to have responded to Penny Wells's sympathy note with a query asking if the FBI had been in touch with her. And what had also been determined was that, however short-lived and unsatisfying the renewal of the relationship turned out to be, it had been Penny Wells who had met MacDonald at the airport when he flew to California in 1971 to take up residence there. As the weeks passed, Victor Warheide began to try to give the grand jurors a deeper level of insight into the character and personality of Jeffrey MacDonald by presenting testimony both from the various psychiatrists and psychologists who had dealt with him professionally and from members of the MacDonald and Kassab families. Mildred Kassab said, "I called Colette on Thanksgiving and she said, 'Well, you can tell Freddie he can cut my throat because I think I'm pregnant.' His joke around the house was that if she became pregnant again, he'd cut her throat because she'd had two very difficult deliveries by cesarean section and, in fact, almost died from internal bleeding after the second. I asked how she felt about it, and she said, 'Well, I don't know. I'm a little unhappy about it, but everyone here is very happy.' And she mentioned that they had 14 for dinner, and Jeff's mother was there. She said, 'Everyone is very happy about it, except me.' Then we went down to visit them for Christmas, and Jeff was short-tempered in testy little ways, such as going into a little storm over, 'I told you, why didn't you pick up my suit?' Little things that were a tempest in a teapot. And Colette never answered, and often I would think, 'Why didn't she say something?' But she never did, and therefore there were never any arguments when I was present. There were many little things here and there that made me unhappy without saying anything, and Colette would never tell me. She kept her problems very much to herself. But I recall, my sister bought a car for Colette because they didn't have a car, and Jeff used it to go to the hospital and to work all the time. This was back in New Jersey or Chicago, and Colette walked with a wagon to do her shopping, carry her laundry, things like that. And one day, Jeff stumbled over some bottles and said something about taking the bottles. Why didn't she take the bottles back to the store? And she said she would get them back next week or something. I said to her after, 'Colette, he has the car. Why don't you tell him to take them back himself?' She said, 'Mommy, don't ever say anything to Jeff because he cannot stand criticism.' And I never did say anything to Jeff, except the time we were down there for Christmas. The atmosphere was very tense for some reason. I didn't realize it at first because Colette, usually she and Kimmy would sit outside and wait for us when we were coming, whether it was Chicago or Bergenfield. If we were coming, they would be waiting on the corner for us. And this day, as we were arriving, we called at 12 o'clock and said we would be there in an hour. Then we had a blowout and had to shop for a tire, and we didn't get there until after 3. And she and Kimmy were still sitting on the corner, waiting for us. And I thought she seemed rather sad, but I thought it was because she was disappointed. We went in, and she had the tree up. I said I was pleased to see it was the first house she'd had a chance to put draperies up, and that it looked nice. But she just didn't respond that much. She was very tense. I don't know why. I suppose it was because of her pregnancy. But there wasn't any laughter or the usual bubbly happiness that you run into when you come down to see one another on Christmas. We went to bed early that night, and the next day was Christmas, and Jeff took us. At 8 o'clock, he said he had a surprise, and we went down, and there was the pony. And of course, I was joyful, and the children were, and I said, "Oh, Colette, this is the beginning for your farm in Connecticut," because she always spoke of someday having a big, old-fashioned house with horses, cows, dogs, etc. And I said, "This is the first live thing for your farm." And she began to weep. I just thought she was awfully touched at the idea of the pony. But since then I've decided perhaps she felt there wasn't going to be that happiness in the future. Then Christmas Day, after that, we were only 4 people and the children. And as a rule, it was the custom in Jeff's family to have a lot of people in. So he suggested calling the next-door neighbors, the people from upstairs. And this was about 4 in the afternoon. And Colette was preparing dinner and very much into Julia Child's cooking at the time. A very ambitious dinner. Everyone does it once in a while. Chooses too many things that you can't do all at once. So I was helping her and she said, "Oh no, don't ask them down because they'll stay and stay, and dinner is started, and they'll stay until 8 o'clock, and we had ducks in the oven." But Jeff was impatient about it, and he called them down anyhow. Well, we were busy in the kitchen, but we took turns going in to sit down. We made drinks and served them. I made eggnog and sat with them a few minutes at a time. And it did get to be 8 o'clock, and the ducks were dried up. No one said anything, though. And after they left, we put the things on the table, and I didn't realize anything was wrong until I realized the silence and looked up and saw the children were not saying anything, and Colette wasn't saying anything. And I said, "What's wrong?" And Jeff said, "Oh, she's always that way when I want someone around. It's just darn bad manners to stay out in the kitchen and not come in." I said, "Well, Jeff, she told you we were busy." Colette had told him in advance that she didn't think I would like it, really, because I hadn't come to visit those neighbors, and she didn't think they were my type, exactly. And after all, since we drove down to see them, why have someone else? I explained that to him, but he just pushed his chair away and left the table. The children said nothing, and Colette had a couple of little tears, and no one said any more about it. I told him I thought he was acting very childish, and he just flung out of the room. I think perhaps why things were so tense at Christmas was because this was possibly a time when they were getting along badly, and she didn't want anything to erupt before us because she wouldn't want us to know anything was wrong. She would never confide in me if she felt that Jeff was unfaithful. She never would because I had been... Too often when we are safe ourselves, we become very complacent, and we are ready to throw stones. And I was always quite noisy about men who chased around and whose wives were submissive. "Do you recall," Victor Warheide asked, "whether there was an ice pick in the house?" "Yes, I do. When I was working at the refrigerator, I had brought some little puff pastry hors d'oeuvres and things down with me for her for the holidays, and they had to go directly into the freezer, and it was already loaded, and I couldn't move the ice trays. So I got the ice pick out, jabbed around until I got the ice trays loose, and could use one of them for the pastry. So I know I used the ice pick." After Christmas, Mildred Kassab said, "My husband felt that Colette might be a little bit angry with him for something, because her voice was different when he called her on the phone. He would call her frequently from his office because he had a trunk line, and she had always been very fond of him since her father died when she was quite young. But after Christmas, she didn't sound the same. I would like to mention also that Colette never forgot a birthday, anniversary, Easter, Mother's Day, and all that sort of thing. There were always cards. But January 19th was Freddie's birthday, and it was the first time in 16 years that he didn't get a card from Colette. The first time she ever forgot. She'd always sent valentines, too, and let the children put their little mark on, and we didn't receive any valentines. We thought about that afterwards. She must have been upset. Do you remember the last time you spoke to her?" "Yes. I called her on, it was the day after a big snowstorm, right around the 14th of February, and she said she was alone. Jeff was working. She said they had taken someone to the airport a day or two before, and she said she was wishing she could have gotten on the plane. And Kimmy had asked, "When can we go to Grandma's again?" And she said they would like so much to be able to come home. And I said, "Well, the snow is very deep and it's covering the pool." There was just a light cover of plastic on the pool, and I was afraid at that time because there was no indication of where the pool was, and we had just put it in. The children wouldn't know where it was, and I said, "Wait until spring." So then she told me Jeff might have to go to Russia with the boxing team, and if he did, he would go in April, and he wouldn't be back until the end of July, and he would be in Russia, so therefore there would be no one would be able to communicate with him, and she would be alone when she had the baby. And would I surely be there on the 18th of July? She really believed that he might forcibly be sent away without asking. In other words, he would have to go. I think she was becoming increasingly worried about the pregnancy. She hadn't been to a doctor yet, and she had already put on 20 pounds, she said, and she was worried about whether it was going to be a very large child. I said, "I will be there. Regardless of anything in the world, I'll be there." The former chief of psychiatry from Walter Reed Army Hospital testified. He was the same doctor who had testified at the Article 32 hearing, but the grand jury setting, with its privacy and absence of cross-examination, permitted him far greater latitude. "The initial question that was put to me," he said, "was that a civilian psychiatrist had evaluated Captain MacDonald and had stated that he was incapable of committing such an act. And so I was asked if I would evaluate him and testify as to my own opinion as to that issue. The first contact I had was with Captain MacDonald's military attorney, who briefed me for about an hour and a half without Captain MacDonald being present, sort of giving his side of the story. Later that afternoon, I was approached by the military prosecutors and by Mr. Ivory, the CID man. They arrived around 4 o'clock, and I was exposed to pictures of the house and the bodies. I considered it a bombardment, and I used that word. Frankly, it was rather disturbing to me, having 6 children of my own. I got out of my office about 6:30. I had a 35-minute drive home, and I trembled as I drove. I lived out in Galesville, Maryland, and when I drove home, it was getting dark. I trembled, and I did not sleep that night. The next day, I saw Dr. MacDonald. I met him at the door and shook hands with him. He was a very cordial, smiling, cooperative, warm person. He expressed his feelings of being upset at having to go through all of this procedure, upset that he was accused, but at the same time, he created an impression of being a very engaging sort of person who was very facile in his ability to talk. I deliberately, in my first interview with him, did not discuss February 17th at all. I did the past history. He gave me a very bland past history of what he considered to be a relatively normal family upbringing, said that it was a happy family. We talked about his father dying of pulmonary fibrosis. He described his father as a leader, as a very masculine type of person, described his father in an interesting way, as a man who was constantly at battle with the world when he didn't need to be. And he described his father as feeling that women, I've got a quote here, that women had taken over the country. I had the impression that between him and his father, in terms of emotional closeness, there was not much. He described his mother as a very calm, quiet, strong person. He talked about his brother, Jay. "Everyone liked Jay," he said. Described Jay as a failure who'd had some 15 to 20 jobs, who was on amphetamines, who'd had a paranoid schizophrenic break. He talked about Judy, his sister. And I got the flavor that somehow, even though his mother was described as a strong person, that somehow, within the family, women were put down. I asked him about himself. he described himself as a striving person, making the point that he would never have achieved what he had achieved or gotten where he had gotten if he had not been a striving person.